that seems to be the thing that most people think about when they think automation. And there's a lot of automation in the world that will probably replace humans. You know, just think of call centers, and if self-driving cars ever land, like, that's a pretty huge percentage of the population that work in those types of industries. But I think when we're talking about industrial automation, I'm not sure I've ever replaced a job with a robot, because people are just so valuable in that space. You know, manufacturing is hard. It's not, you know, you don't just wake up one morning and press automate and everything runs.
Welcome to the Manufacture Houston podcast, where Houston's manufacturers come to share, learn, and grow. Brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com.
In today's episode of the Manufacture Houston podcast, we talk to Lance Douglas with Olympus Controls. We talk through the approach of industrial automation on today's manufacturing environment and how focusing on tasks that are dull, dirty, and dangerous are actually a way of putting humans at the top of the food chain in the world of manufacturing. I'm sure you'll love today's episode.
Okay, Lance, welcome to the Manufacture Houston podcast. I'm so happy to have you on today. I'm really excited about what we're going to talk about, the world of automation. And so before we jump into that, give us an intro about you, about who you work for, and then we'll jump into the meaty stuff.
Sounds great. Thanks, Mush. Glad to be here. Yeah, so a little background on me. I'm an automation engineer presently at Olympus Controls. I'm a mechanical engineering graduate of the University of Texas. I have some oil and gas experience working deep water for BP, and then a very short stint contracting at NASA in White Sands. So I've got a kind of an all over the place background, but I think I'm going to be sticking with automation in the future. It's kind of a short tidbit of kind of where I started and where I'm at now. Yeah, looking forward to, cool. to discussing some automation and robots with you.
That's awesome. Well, so that's an interesting background, both the oil and gas industry and the space industry. How has that helped you tackle some of the things that you're doing now?
It's certainly very Houston. yeah, the background has been really a good, it's been a series of stepping stones to get to kind of where I'm at today. And it helps with automation to have seen the background of, you know, how things work in the physical world, right? You go to school and you're taught all the theoretical things you could ever want to know, but you really have to get out in the field and see people working and see how these things are implemented to get a good understanding of what it looks like in the real world. It's always very different from the theoretical world when you jump in and start actually trying to tackle some problems.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So automation. So I'm guessing this is not like Terminator style robots walking around factories doing all sorts of crazy things. So for the people that don't know about industrial automation, tell us what it means from your perspective, and we'll dig into more details as we go through this conversation, but let's keep it pretty high level for right now and tell us what you think. What are the basics of industrial automation?
Yeah. So industrial automation basically covers anything that automates a task, and that can range from a huge number of directions. But basically, from a simple standpoint, you have actuation, which is driven by motors and drives, hydraulics or pneumatics in some cases, you know, conveyors moving product from place to place. You have sensors and, you know, vision, things like that see and feel the world around them that can tell people and machines more information, you know, in an automated fashion. And then, of course, you have other things like barcodes and labels and RFID and laser marking that actually mark parts. And that's kind of an interesting subset of automation. But without that, it's really hard to automatically track product and where things are going. An extension of that is, you know, kind of networking and software. So those are maybe a little less about what we'll cover today, you know, but growing on actuation, you can get into systems and robots. And then, you know, fully integrated systems that do very complex things. But we'll probably focus on, you know, ranging from actuation to robot and then dip into system integration a little bit today.
Yeah. So that sounds, I can imagine how that might sound pretty complicated to some people listening. So when you're talking to your customers and clients and, you know, they're thinking about automating things, what's a good place to begin? What are the first few things that people should be thinking about before they go buy a bunch of robots or add a bunch of camera systems, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that have kind of struck me as useful is starting with dull, dirty, and dangerous. We call it the three Ds a lot of times. So dull is anything that's boring, low skill required, it's repetitive. You know, we find that people are just extremely valuable in what they can do. The system that we are is just incredible with our brains and our fingers and eyes and all the, you know, processing brain power that goes along with it. People are extremely valuable. So eliminating dull tasks, things that are just really boring, don't really have any value for a human to be doing, you know, very repetitive pick and place, you know, doing the same thing over and over and over again all day. That's a good place to start with dull. And then, you know, dirty, anytime there's any kind of hazard in terms of, you know, air cleanliness, you know, you get into that with some welding and grinding and polishing and painting and anything that's dirty, anything that's going to get, you know, could potentially get people hurt or sick or have long-term, you know, effects. That's usually a good second kind of place to start. So we've got dull and dirty and then dangerous, you know, first and foremost, obvious hazards. You know, those are easier to see usually, but, you know, it's often overlooked that repetitive stress injuries can be a problem for a lot of people. So if you're doing something that's repetitive that you're doing all day for years and years, you know, you're going to have potential problems with stress injuries like your hands, your back, shoulders, elbows. And that's just, you know, that's a lower quality of life for people. And we want to try to avoid that and improve their lives. So dull, dirty, and dangerous is usually a great place to start. I know that covers a pretty broad range, but we can dive into some of those applications here.
Yeah, so that is a really interesting way to think about automation and not anything that I've heard before. So dull, dirty, and dangerous. The other thing that you said in your comments, Lance, was that it was clear that the way you think about this is that humans are the valuable part of this entire process. Because I know there's a lot of angst and controversy perhaps about robots or automation eliminating humans, but that doesn't seem like what you're saying. That am I thinking about that the right way?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So that seems to be the thing that most people think about when they think automation. And there's a lot of automation in the world that will probably replace humans. You know, just think of call centers, and if self-driving cars ever land, like that's a pretty huge percentage of the population that work in those types of industries. But I think when we're talking about industrial automation, I'm not sure I've ever replaced a job with a robot because people are just so valuable in that space. You know, manufacturing is hard. It's not, you know, you don't just wake up one morning and press automate and everything runs. You know, these things require work. They require high level people to get that running and maintain the cell. And so what we've seen is, you know, a common application is machine tending, which I'm sure we'll talk plenty about, but machine tending is it can be very repetitive. It can be dull. You know, it can be dangerous. You're around high powered machines all day. And if you can put a robot or something like that on that machine to tend it, that worker doesn't get replaced. He kind of gets promoted because now he's a robot manager. And so he can grow with the business and say he starts by managing one machine. He can then expand and run two or three or four machines in a work cell. And so his pay goes up, his value is higher, his job is less monotonous. And so, you know, you end up keeping that guy versus him flipping and going to another company. So, you know, as the business grows, as they're able to get cost down per part by automating, you know, you end up with higher level people in your organization.
Yeah, I think that is a really great example. So let's dig deeper into the idea of machine tending as a use case for robotic automation. So maybe Lance, you can take us through a real life example of where you worked with a company to put in some kind of machine tending automation, and what the results were there for the company and also for the person that was previously tending that machine.
Yeah, for sure. So one example always comes to mind as being, you know, kind of a standout example. They're not always quite this good, but in this particular case, they're manufacturing a high value part, and it required two machines of operation. So each machine had a dual spindle, and what we ended up doing was creating a work cell between two machines with one robot. So imagine a machine on the left and a machine on the right and a robot in the middle. And then behind the robot between the machines is your infeed, outfeed. So we helped the customer to design an infeed, outfeed system that would take raw materials in, and then the robot would grab the raw material from the feed. It would put it in machine A. It would take machine A spindle 2 out and put that in machine B, and then swap those two as well, and then put the finished product on the outfeed. And so, you know, it's a multi-stage part. We had a dual gripper on it. And so what ended up happening was the throughput went through the roof, and this is a high value part. And so we actually, you know, when it was all said and done, you know, it was a few weeks, maybe a month for this particular one, because it was a little more complex. We were interfacing with two machines, which we did in this case with IO. So we used M-code relays and IO. So we had some minor changes to the machine code programming. And there's other ways to do that now. But we wired an IO there, and then the dual gripper, you know, that's two different TCPs or tool center points on the robot. And you teach each one of those based on where the gripper meets the part. And then, you know, programming your infeed outfeed points, those are going to be very repeatable. And that's maybe the most important part of the whole system is infeed outfeed being repeatable, because if that's not repeatable, the work cell just won't work. And so putting all those pieces together, we ended up with a very efficient work cell that could run, I wouldn't say fully lights out, because somebody still has to feed the parts in, you know, based on the time that it takes to go through them, but basically unmanned. And so the work cell had a very fast ROI. I mean, I think it was a few weeks, to be honest. It was like 8 weeks or something. It was just insane because the part value is so high.
Yeah. So then in that case, I would imagine that the human that was tending that machine before didn't have the ability to repeat that work over and over again as reliably and consistently as the robot did. And maybe because that goes back to what you said about the work being maybe dull, after a while, that human's just not going to be that productive doing repetitive work like that.
Yeah, correct. And so, you know, that guy now manages the cell, and, you know, he has time to go and do other things for the company. So he didn't, you know, they didn't lose any jobs there. They just changed the way the workflow went. So you keep good people on, and you keep them working on things that robots just quite frankly can't do, which is, there's plenty of that.
Yeah, there certainly is. So do you find in your experience, Lance, that do the people on the shop floor resist the implementation of these kinds of robotic solutions? And if they do, what have you learned has been a good way to manage that resistance and help them transition to higher value, more human work?
Yeah, of course. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. I think it depends more on the application. But a lot of times the reason people look to robots to begin with is because they don't have those people. There's a shortage of workers in this space. And it seems like every machine shop I go to, the first thing is, well, we don't have good people to run machines. And so, you know, if a robot can do that, yeah, that solves that problem, you know, for the business. But then when you go to a place where they already have good machinists, you know, it's important to kind of tell them the advantages, like, hey, you won't have to do this boring job anymore, or, you know, this repetitive, you know, all day of making parts. Now, good machinists, don't get me wrong, a good machinist will already be doing other things. In the experience that I've had, a good machinist is already going to be working on designing parts. They're going to be optimizing the CNC program. You know, they're going to be doing things that are higher value than just taking parts in and out of the machine. So for those people, I think they already understand that there's more value to be had than just the pick and place of it. And then for the ones that just do the pick and place, you know, it, they do kind of get an upgrade if they're good, and the business wants to keep them running in that kind of work cell. So they mm-hmm. then become a robot technician instead of a CNC operator.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting insight that for many businesses, it's not that robotic automation or industrial automation is replacing humans. It's that in many cases, it's hard to find people to man those work cells to begin with. So it's almost like a necessity to have a robot doing it when you can't find the right human to do it.
Exactly.
So let's go a bit deeper on types of robots. So I can imagine that for people that have not been around the types of automation systems that we're talking about, let's stick with tending robots as a specific use case. Maybe people have an impression that these robots are maybe even physically are human-like and may behave that way, but I know it's not that. So tell us, I know this is audio, so maybe hard to describe, but do your best shot of sort of describing what a typical tending robot looks like and how you go about just implementing it in an application like this.
Yeah, so at its core, a robot is just a series of articulated joints or axes. So from a very basic definition, something that moves in X and Y would be considered a robot. That's a very basic level, and that's what a lot of gantry systems are considered robots. But when we're talking about robots here, what we're mostly considering is six-axis robots. There's four-axis SCARA, and some have seven axes, and you put a six axes on a seventh axis rail and you can add other things. But for the core of the robot, it's six axes, which is basically six motorized joints that all act together to make a kinematic motion in 3D space. So the joint one and joint two and three all the way to the end of the arm work together to go from point A to point B. Those are usually done in, like a joint move in 3D space where it kind of arcs in the most efficient path, or it can go, linearly point to point. And both of those require just a tremendous amount of math, which is what happens in the controller. So a lot of people ask, well, what's going on in this little box here? It's a computer running a bunch of math all the time. Mm-hmm. And so a six axis arm, what that allows you to do is have 6 degrees of freedom and joint articulation. And that's why we use them in machines and other applications, because they can become square to a surface or a plane, and they can stay that way while moving in other axes in other directions. So like fixing in the Z and moving in the X and Y, for example. Does that kind of answer the question?
Yeah, that makes sense. So it allows you to sort of hold position in unique ways and in a way that probably a human cannot do easily. So it's basically an arm that is programmable to move in a number of different ways. One of the things you said earlier was how you connect that robot to the machines that it's tending. Tell us more about that and how easy or difficult it is to connect multiple machines together so it actually works like a manufacturing cell.
Yeah. So it can be a little complicated depending on the machine, and the age of the machine sometimes can be an issue, but there's a few ways to do it. You can hardwire into, start, stop buttons and things like that. Or you can wire into the back of the machine. A lot of times there's some unused M-code relays. And so we'll use, a remote IO unit to plug into the back of the machine, and then we connect that to the robot over an Ethernet line and then talk Modbus TCP to it, or we hardwire into it. And then inside the machine code, there's M codes, which are basically the instructions for the machine to run. And we can use those to communicate back and forth to the robot, basically a handshake of IOs. And that's kind of the basic way of doing it. There's other devices out there that will plug into the robot that are basically plug and play with different brands of machine. So if you have a Haas or an Akuma, or if it's got a Fanuc controller in the back, they have software written now that can plug into those and just talk directly to the machine instead of doing that hard IO.
So does this require custom programming? Like does someone maybe on your team, but someone actually have to like write lines of code, or do you see that things are developing to the point where that integration work is becoming more intuitive?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's very robot dependent. So at Olympus, we distribute a lot of different types of robots. Collaborative for us is Universal Robots, and we have other brands such as Epson and Kawasaki and Denso. And when you look at the industrial side, it's very much a programming endeavor. That's traditionally how it's always been done. And so, yes, in that case, you would have to write some real code to get it done. But with Universal Robots, it's a little different. They have an open source platform that's kind of like a good analogy is your iPhone. Apple makes the phone, and then third-party developers make apps for it. And then they can post that on the App Store, and you download it. And it's kind of a plug and play for that app to do what the app does. And so for UR, the third-party developers make software for the grippers. They make software for screwdriving kits, for dispensing kits, for machine tending communication kits. And all that is basically a plug and play software into the robot. And so once you have that on the robot, it's just usually a few taps and an IP address to get connected to a machine. And then a few more taps to get your robot working with the gripper and you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I remember that we had looked at, this was a couple of years ago, I think, a Universal Robot, and you'd actually demoed it for us. You put a robot, and tell me if I'm remembering this wrong, Lance, but you put a small version of a Universal Robot on our desk, and you handed me an iPad with, what looked like an iPad, with a button positioned based on where the hand holder is on the iPad. You said, okay, follow the instructions. And the instructions said, press the button on the screen, which I did. Then the next step was move the robot arm from point A to point B while holding down the button, which I did. Then the on-screen instructions said, now release the button, which I did. And basically I'd program the robot. Did I dream that? Or is that kind of how it happened?
That's pretty close. It's been that easy for a while, but they're adding so much new software. And it's just making it's making programming easier, but it's also making basically everything else you can interface with easier. So as this continues to grow, I think there are around 50,000 robots now. And as the software continues to get better for this and industrial robots, not to discount industrial robots, they're incredibly useful tools. And if you know how to program them, they're really valuable, and they can go up to, like 3,000, 3,200 pound payloads. Mm-hmm. And we're already seeing some software come out for industrial robots that looks like that as well. So, a company called Ready Robotics recently released a software that plugs into any industrial robot and can program it from that interface. So there's already more software being developed to make robots easier to use. And that's really changing the industry, because traditionally you needed a whole staff of automation engineers and robot programmers, for example, like in the auto industry, they've been using robots for tens of years now. And they have people on staff that change them over and reprogram them every year based on the model. And that's not really sustainable for a mom and pop shop who has machines that they need to tend or, gluing or dispensing, polishing. All the different applications that are easily accessible today are that way because of the software that's used to program. So it's gotten much easier. To anybody that's interested in looking at that, my first recommendation is always, talk to an expert. People do this day in and day out, myself included. It's really easy to get in contact with people and say like, hey, where do we stand? How hard is this application? Is this going to cost a lot, or is it going to take months, or, in a lot of cases, is it going to take days? I guess that kind of leads into timeline. If we're talking about a timeline for automation, I always recommend start with the low hanging fruit, start small and add incrementally until you have a fully automated system. That's going to be the surefire way to do it and be successful, because a lot of people try to jump into it and say like, oh, okay, well, automation sounds great. We need it everywhere. And, mm-hmm. you know, you can throw a bunch of money at it and hire a systems integrator and have everything done for you. But that does cost money. So there's a balance between how much of it can we do ourselves or should we do ourselves versus how much of it can we get a little help with versus how much of it do we need turnkey?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that there's a couple of things that you said that are, I think, very interesting. The example of the iPhone or any smartphone and the development community that is now part of that whole ecosystem, making tools that normal humans can use, that I think what you're saying is that whole dynamic is happening in the industrial world too. You know, obviously a decade or more later than that's happened on consumer products, but making it easier for people to leverage this kind of automation is certainly going to cause the faster and faster spread of this kind of technology. The other thing you said, I think, that was super interesting, Lance, is that understanding the best place to begin and finding that one application that the customer is going to think is going to make a big difference in their business, and just sticking with that and understanding how best to apply it seems like that's a good place to really focus.
Yeah, I think so. You know, low-hanging fruit and you know, identifying low-hanging fruit may not be the easiest thing if you're not familiar with automation. So again, you know, bringing somebody out on site to look at it is always a good idea. Usually doesn't cost anything, but some time.
Sure. So then, let's talk about, I'm going to have you put your time machine hat on. We've talked about sort of the state of robotics today and perhaps a little bit about how things have developed. So if you think about the next 5 years or so, how do you see the world of robotics and automation changing over the next few years? What do you think of the new kinds of technologies or technology improvements that are going to happen over that period of time?
Yeah, well, starting with software, I mean, it's getting better every year, and software is going to change the way that we interact with these things. It's going to make it more accessible for everybody, and it really has to. Otherwise, you know, we're not going to remain competitive, you know, globally. So I think there's a lot of onshoring happening to bring business back to Houston, and I think that, you know, and the United States in general. And I think that we need more of these types of technologies out there, more robots, more general automation. And I think that, you know, in the next few years, we're going to see kind of a boom where we see more of these technologies come in and we see more software being developed that makes it more readily accessible. And I really think we're going to see it take off. You know, it already is, to be honest, but I think we'll see that trend continue to increase. And more people will find value in doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. I think you're right about that. So let's say, I'll give you another sort of what if question. Let's say you're talking to a young person, and perhaps this person, maybe they did go to college, maybe they didn't go to college, but they have some sort of aptitude around manufacturing. What advice would you give them about being one of the humans that can help implement this robotic revolution and be part of a positive change for manufacturing?
Yeah, I think for most young people, my advice is probably going to be, you know, be active and, you know, find something that you care about. I feel like a lot of people wait for the world to kind of hit them, you know, yeah. And, you know, the way to go is to really attack it and find something that you're interested in and get good at it. You know, just take action. And if you're interested in robotics and automation in this space, you know, just become active. There's a lot of free resources out there. You know, everything from an Arduino up is just experience that does directly translate into this type of technology. So anything you can get into, you know, hardware you can learn about, you know, software you can program, you know, just learning the basics of it will really go a long way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really good advice. I think jumping in and just maybe even just building something.
There's 3D printer kits out there that's a great place to start. That gives you a background on controls and how all this stuff goes together. It's all the same stuff. It's just a bunch of motors controlling axes. It's just how do they work together for the end product.
Yeah. And I think this the best way to learn it is by doing it. I mean, I think it's great to watch YouTube videos and even listen to podcasts about like this one, but nothing beats the idea of just building something and figuring it out, even if it messes up the first 20 times that you're doing it.
Yeah, sometimes you need to fail a bunch of times, but you know, before you really get it. But there's so many resources out there, and that the resources are only growing.
Yep, agree. So Lance, if someone today is listening to this and they are running a manufacturing business or running the operations within manufacturing somewhere, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you so that you could have a conversation with them, you could come out and see them, and maybe help them at least understand where they may begin?
Yeah. Is it safe to drop a phone number?
Please. Yeah. As long as you don't mind people calling you.
No, call away. So I'm here in Houston. My phone number is 832-297-4343. And just mentioned it was from the podcast, so I'll know who you are maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, just call me. You know, we do, you know, I guess you'd call it free consulting, but basically we'll come out and we'll look at stuff with you and see what's easy to automate, what's hard to automate. You know, I have a pretty good idea of what things are going to cost, you know, especially if they go the integrated route, you know, cause that's where the cost really starts to come in. So if it's something that you want to do yourself, or, you know, I know a lot of, you know, small business owners look at this type of technology and they say, oh, I can't do that. But most of the customers that I've worked with that have been successful have all been small business owners, and they all just have a get it done attitude, and they usually get it done. So, you know, I wouldn't be afraid of it.
Yeah. And my experience with you and with Olympus is that there's ways to sort of de-risk it too. There's ways to test it and to, you know, not to jump in with both feet, but find a place that may not cost a ton of money to begin, but at least you can start building your automation literacy. And then once you've gained some sense of confidence and comfort, then you can begin to take the next step. So it's not like, you know, a business owner has to automate their entire factory floor within the first 3 months. It's really about just finding a sensible place to begin. Is that a good way to think about it?
100%. There's no rush. You know, at the end of the day, it's just another tool, right? You know, you think a long time about which CNC is going to work best for your needs, you know, and as a machine tending example, but it's just another tool. You know, it's not some crazy off the wall thing to look at robots. It's really just another tool. It's meant to work for humans. That's really all it does. It doesn't do anything you don't tell it to. So,
well, that's a great way to wrap up, Lance. So we can sort of dispel the Terminator robot fear that maybe some of us are thinking about, that robots really do what we tell them to do, which I think is a great way to summarize what you said in the beginning, which is this is something for humans, and that the humans are still very much at the top of the food chain when it comes to this.
Absolutely. Very, very important. And I might end with a quote, sure, if you don't mind.
Please.
So, you know, Elon, everybody knows Elon Musk and Tesla and all of his ventures, but Tesla had an idea that they were going to automate everything. Elon Musk at one point had said, you know, I want the robots to be so fast, air resistance becomes a problem. So, you know, at the end of the day, that ended up not being the case. And he said, you know, Tesla relied on excessive automation, and it really hurt them when they were getting into manufacturing, you know, automobiles. And so, you know, excess automation was bad. And, you know, he was also quoted saying, you know, humans are underrated. You know, they're just so valuable. The people we work with and the people that are working for us are doing incredible things, and they're very, very valuable.
Yeah, well said. I think that's a great quote. So, Lance, thank you so much for joining us today. I think it was a really great discussion about industrial automation. And I know there's a big world, and we could probably talk for hours on just one of these areas. But I really do appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Take care.
This has been the Manufacture Houston podcast, brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com. If you'd like to be on the show or want to recommend someone to get on the show, just reach out to me on LinkedIn, MUSHKHAN, Mushkan. and look forward to hearing from you.